Okay, Tov, it is wonderful to see everybody back. Today we're going to be learning about one of the most fascinating characters, one of the most fascinating individuals, the Netziv, Rav Natzari Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. Thank you, everybody, for coming as we learn a little bit together. No doubt many of us have learned and heard of the Netziv, but to appreciate him in full, we need to spend a little bit of time together as well. Special Mazel Tov to Nobi and Shulamis on the engagement to their son, Be'ezra Hashem. The wedding should be B'Shah Tova and Mitzlachas. We're going to jump into this really remarkable life in just the next few minutes. And Netziv, actually, the word itself, which is the acronym of his name, Natali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, is Netziv is actually also means a pillar, and that became the name of the Netziv. And you'll find his sorim in every base medrash that you go. There's our Netziv is just in the back shop over there next to the Ramban. And he is found in every base medrash, his commentary on the Torah. He didn't just write on the Torah, but he wrote many, many things. But let's start off over here. Understand his life. He was born in Mir in the Russian Empire and ultimately passed away in Warsaw in Poland. But for the most of his life, he spent his life in Volozhin. Volozhin is a small village which is in the Russian Empire. Put the map over here. Today it's in today's Belarus. When the USSR fell apart, so between Belarus, Bialystok on the side of Lithuania today, and he married into an illustrious family. He was the Rosh Yeshiva. I apologize, I actually misrepresented over here. The first Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva in Volozhin, which became known as of the Volozhin Yeshiva, was Rav Chaim of Volozhin, not Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim of Volozhin. He is famous for being one of the paramount students of the Vilna Gaon, and also the author of what we call Nefesh HaChaim. The Nefesh HaChaim, which was essentially a response to the Sefer HaTanya of the first Lubavitch Rebbe. And very much in the camp of what was called Misnagdim, which means to say opposing the proliferation of Chassidus. It was when this issue was formed in the year 1803, 1806, the differing versions of this. Just to understand the background of the Yeshiva, there were two opposing forces that were affecting the nation of Israel at this time. Force number one was that of the Haskalah, as the Enlightenment moved from the Western European countries, from Germany, from France, they moved into the East. It started arriving in the Russian Empire as well. And the closer you were to Germany, the more this affected the Jews there. And this of course, affected the political arena of Russia itself. But for the moment, what matters to us is how it affects the Jews. And that's one of the movements, just pulling Jews away from traditional Judaism, from practice as well. That's one element that's affecting Jews at this time. Another element which is affecting Jews is the movement towards Chassidus. The Chassidus actually was, generally speaking, moving from the East. It's interesting, because Chassidus really spoke a lot to the uneducated, the people who are unschooled, unlettered, and instead of finding their meaning in greater academic Judaism, and study and going to the yeshivas in the same way, the Chassidim, to a large degree, were very simple people who found a tzaddik, and the tzaddik was usually a Baal Moifes of sorts, and the people were very much, this gave them the little meaning they had in a very difficult life in the pale of settlement out east, and this was moving westwards in general. And it's interesting, at this point in time, the establishment of the Volozhin yeshiva was a response on both sides to this, is to elevate the learning of Torah itself, for the sake of learning of Torah, as Rav Chaim talks about in the Nefesh HaChaim, and he founds this yeshiva based on that principle. And this yeshiva ultimately became known as the mother of all yeshivas. We'll see in a moment why that's so significant. After Rav Chaim Volozhin, he really actually takes his son, Rav Yitzchak of Volozhin, to be the Rosh Yeshiva while in his last years. When he passes away, the Rav Yitzchak of Volozhin takes his stead, and that's from the year 1821 all the way till 1813, when he starts as a Korosh Yeshiva, to 1849. And the Yeshiva starts with 10 students, and by the time we reach 1849, we already have 200 students. It's now very well known. It's a Yeshiva of great acclaim across Europe. This is the building blocks of Lithuanian Yeshivas. It's in the year of 1849 that things change, in that Rabbi Yitzchak of Elazar, the second Rosh Yeshiva, who's now the second generation of this family, passes away, and it goes to his son-in-law, Rav Eliezer Yitzchak Fried. One of the reasons it goes to his son-in-law is his son-in-law is brilliant. His son-in-law is the scion of the currency of Lithuanian Torah giants, which is brilliance. That was that's who it went to. Unfortunately, he passed away very soon afterwards. He passed away within 5 years of assuming the stewardship of the yeshiva. And it was at such a point that the second son-in-law of Rav Yitzchak of Elazar took the reins, and his name was Rav Naftali Tzihuda of Berlin. So he became the Rosh Yeshiva. In general, you'll notice that yeshivas generally have a family. It's a family business. Somebody once said to me, it is the reward for the immense difficulty that it takes to run an institution. And I think there's a lot to be said with that. If you look at a lot of the yeshiva system, it's usually one family. And it's usually one family and cousins and sons-in-law and so on. And so those on the outside are critical and they say it's nepotism. But it takes a lot. It's a very, very difficult and arduous process to run a yeshiva. And it's usually in debt. And people usually don't pay enough to support it. And they can't pay the staff on time. That's just how it works with any yeshiva. And so the reward of that is that there has to be something. And so Rav Naftali Tzihuda Berlin became the Rosh Yeshiva afterwards. It should be noted that if you read some of the biographies about the Netziv, he was not a brilliant, a maverick, right? A lightning speed mind, as it seems. He was of average intelligence, as his nephew describes him. And he worked really hard. He worked really hard to get to where he was. In fact, as his nephew describes in his biography of his uncle, he describes that his father-in-law didn't think necessarily that he was, the rakat from the cloth to be the Rosh Yeshiva. And his wife didn't think so either. He was a very, very, he was a hard-working individual, and he worked so hard until they started reading his writings, and they realized, wait a second, he really does have what it takes. And it's really a fascinating story of his building the yeshiva to its immense success at its height, and it's in the next 40 years under which the yeshiva is his. The yeshiva grows to over 500 students, between 400 and 500 students, and it becomes essentially the generator of all the other yeshivas of Lithuanian heritage. Just to give you a sense of the sum of the graduates of the yeshiva, we have Rav Motel Epstein, the Rosh Yeshiva of Slobodka, Rav Chaim Ozer Grodzinski, that are based in Vilna, Rav Chaim Mordechai Katz, Rosh Yeshiva of Telz, Rav Baruch Aber Leibowitz, the Rosh Yeshiva of Slobodka and then later Kamenitz, Rav Issa Zalman Melz, the Rosh Yeshiva of Slutz and later on Eitz Chaim in Yerushalayim, Rav Shmuel Moliva, the founder of the Chovev Eitz Yon movement, Rav Yitzchak Isaac Alevi, the founder of the Agudas Yisrael movement, Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, the founder of Mizrahi, Rav Yosef Zundel Salant, the teacher of Yisrael Salanta, Rav Shimon Shkop, the Rosh Yeshiva of Telz and later Grodna, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav of Brisk, Rav Yitzchak Alchon Inspector, the namesake of Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Alchon, which is Ritz, that's Yeshiva University's yeshiva, Rav Aaron Yitzchak Cohen Cook, the first chief rabbi of the British Benedict of Palestine, Kalman Zev Wisotsky, the founder of the tea company, he was a graduate, and also Nachum Chaim Bialik, the great poet, Yiddish and Hebrew poet, many, many. I would challenge everybody to see if they can match the names. Of course, many, many others. Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein, his nephew and brother-in-law. Of course, Rav Meir Bar-Ilan, his son, Rav Chaim Berlin, his other son. A very, very illustrious caliber. And if you've noticed this, almost every yeshiva movement, the yeshiva of Slutsk, of course, later on the Rosh Yeshiva was Rav Aaron Kotler, who moved then to America, who established Lakewood. Right, so we're talking about, Rav Riddleman, who learned in Slobodka. Of course, Slobodka was an outshoot of Elazar, if you want to, and that turned into Eretz Yisrael. So if you want to understand, the map of the yeshiva world today, it all starts really in Elazar. Elazar is the generator of all of the Rosh Yeshiva, the cadre of Lithuanian Torah Jewry, the highest of the highest of levels were from Elazar yeshiva until its closing in 1892. And this is a very
lake would have the same shayrish.
100%. In fact, there's a lot to appreciate this. You should know Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan was a merger with I believe Eitz Chaim in Brooklyn, and then ultimately only became Yeshiva University in the 1920s. Under Rav Dov Revel, So there's a lot to talk about. Really, really fast in the history of the yeshiva movement as we have it, we have it today. So we'll get to what's closing in just a moment. Just to appreciate this time, it's a complicated time. We'll get to some of the complexities of his leadership, some of the difficult challenges from within and without. But he wrote an incredible amount. So his first, we'll call it, contribution that people are aware of, which is Ha'emek Sha'ela, which is a very unusual book. It's written on the She'iltos of Rav Achai Gaon, which is unusual because the She'iltos is a halachic work on the Torah, but it's written from the Gaonic period. And what was interesting about the Netziv was he shifted away from just pure study of Gemara, and he was already we'll call it a broader bookshelf in terms of who he was studying and writing on. And the She'iltos became his famous contribution, his Ha'emek Sha'ela. And he wrote many other svarim. So he wrote the most famous one that we're dealing with is the Ha'emek Davar. Let me just get one off the shelf quickly. So this is the Ha'emek Davar of the Netziv. This is his Chelek Baraishis. The old ones are these blue, very thin blue volumes. This is the more recent publication with easier lettering to read. He wrote Meshiv Davar, or his responsa. He wrote Mereme Sadeh. It's amazing how much he actually wrote. He wrote the Rina Shel Torah, which is on the Shir HaShirim, Birkas HaNetziv on the Mechilta, Igros HaNetziv with his letters, Drashas HaNetziv, were published later on, Mamar Shel Yisrael, the role of Israel and Golos, and Imre Shefer on the Haggadah. There's a lot that the Netziv has to say. And usually very formidable, very insightful perspectives on this as well. Ultimately, the yeshiva closed down, and he passed away very shortly after. Let's talk about the closing of the yeshiva for just a moment. But I'd like to start off with some of his teachings. The Netziv is renowned. Actually, he writes in his introduction to Ha'emek Davar, the depth of the matter, on his commentary on the Torah. He writes an introduction called Kidmas Ha'emek, which is the introduction to the depths, because his book Ha'emek Davar is the depths of the matter. So the Kidmas Ha'emek, he writes that this sefer is an outcome of his teachings, of his shirim in the yeshiva. So one of the things he would do is he'd give a shir on Torah, which is also, again, a little bit, you know, avant-garde for some who were focused purely on Talmud. He spent a lot of time, and he describes how he would go through many of the mefarshim, and he says, this is not in the sources, but And I tried to understand based on what I had in front of me. Haramban, Rashbam, Sforna, Rabbi Avram ben Ezra, Meshar, Mefarsha Torah, Lonif Nesili Rois, Kia Sforim, Harbe, Boze, and Kates. And he describes, by the way, we spent time with all of them in the past weeks. And he says, I spent a lot of time trying to unpack the issues with them as well. And he feels that it's worthy of writing down. So this is the outcome of many of the shirim he gives. And he says, and I don't want to belabor the reader with long essays. And so I write in shorter manners, but I also, for longer issues that relate to other aspects of halacha or Tanakh, I'll put it in the footnotes, which are called harachev davar, expansion of the matter. That's for the longer issues that I don't want to address in the actual pirush itself. Let's look at an example and then come back to some of the complexities of the Netziv to live with. So we're going to go each idea over here is overwhelming. They're just very, very powerful ideas. The Netziv is remarkable. I hope to leave everybody with a little bit of an imprint on just this today. So first is the observation he makes on the Migdal Bavel. This tower, which was made in Babylon in what we call Dara Palaga, Dara Flaga, as some people say, in the 11th chapter of Bereshis. And in it, he describes how they had Dvarim Achadim. They had one intention. What does it mean with Dvarim Achadim? So he says the following in the second source. He says, Amnam yesh lahavin ma chashashum yatsu kama la'eretz acheres. It says, they're worried, pend our foot. Let's not get dispersed, so we need to have one language. So it says, and so what? Who cares if they go? Leave. Goodbye. If you don't want to be here, goodbye. Why is that such an issue of magnitude to them? Umuvan shezayah shayach ledvarim achadim shebeneihem. This relates to their philosophy of having one matter. Vaasher ein dayos ba bnei adam shavim chashishu shelo yotzu bnei adam midayazu. V'yu b'machshava acheres, they were worried that people had a different ways of thinking. Al-kain hayu mashkichim shelo yetzei ish miyushav shelohem. They did not allow anybody out of the way that, of their settlement. U'mish esar midavarim achadim shebeneim ha-mishpata l'sreifa kasher osu l'Avram avinu. And anybody who wanted to leave their culture would be burnt, like they tried to kill Avram for monotheism, which was an avoidance of their culture. Nimsa, it comes out, hayu dvarim achadim shebeneim l'ro'etz. Their adorim achadim wasn't, oh, we all love the same ideas. No, no, it was imperialism. It was being forced upon everybody. Sheikhlitu la'arog es mi shelo yachshov kedatam. They wanted to kill those who didn't think like them. This is one of the greatest challenges that Tziv has from without, and that is dealing with the Russian Empire. The Russian Empire, Russia, Rishayim and Rushayim, the worst of the worst of evil people who are leading Russia in the 19th century. Just an example, the second half of the 19th century. The second half is we have Alexander II, the Tsar, who rules from 1855 to 1881. Ultimately, upon his death, he's killed by anarchists, and they blame the Jews. The Jews are blamed for this, and so Alexander III, who was a terrible, terrible, he's called the peacekeeper. The amount of blood upon his hands, hard to imagine. From 1881 and 1894, he actually condoned the uprisings against the Jews in the Pale of Settlement. He allowed and he augmented the Cossack pogroms throughout that time. At this time, 1881 is a very significant year because that's when the rise in anti-Semitic attacks starts. And this is now when there's this mass exodus of Russian Jewry. Russian Jewry are desperately trying to leave. That's when the mass immigration to America starts. Right, so millions of Russian Jews are making their way, Eastern European Jews are making their way to America before America, with the Anti-Immigration League, closes the door upon the immigrants, sealing their fate in Russia and Europe. But ultimately, this is the period where Jews, this is now, if you read the annals of history, it's literally pogrom after pogrom after pogrom through the 80s, through the 90s, through the zeros, leading up to, you know, the Kishinev pogrom in 1903 was just one of the publicized ones. But if you go through it, terrible, terrible things that were going on under the auspices of these czars. And Nicholas II, also part of the Romanov dynasty, essentially recessed himself after his failed war against Japan, and recessed himself. The more he recessed himself, ultimately became the victim of many of the reformers, the anarchists of the time, leading to his overthrow and his murder and the massacre of his family in 1917, leading to the USSR. This is really a very difficult time for the Jews. As part of the Russian Empire's program is also the educational unification of the subjects under them, and Russia is struggling, as every other country is, with the values that are coming from the West. So Russia, Germany was dealing with this, England was dealing with this, France was dealing with this. All these countries are dealing with, on the one hand, the monarchists, those who supported monarchy in the good old way in the feudal system, now being overtaken by Western values of liberty, of democracy, and the struggle that entailed with this. If you want to understand what was going on around the Dreyfus trial, that was those two sets of forces in France at war with each other, which split the country in two, and that was in the 1890s. In Germany, you have the monarch, who's the king, who has to make concessions all the time to the public, right, and ultimately drove them into World War I. Very, very complicated time. Russia did not manage to smell the coffee fast enough. So Russia knew they were coming in with the new ideas from the West, ideas which were not in support of monarchy, and they tried many things to do to be able to stop, to stem that tide. Ultimately, ultimately, Russia is different to the Western European side because most of the people were uneducated, right? So they had that advantage, which is why it was slower to infiltrate. But one of the movements they did was the unification of the Russian Empire, which was that they tried to control the education system. Everybody had to learn in Russian and everybody had to learn Russian subjects. And new ideas, avant-garde subjects, were seen as dangerous. Among them were communism. Among them were Zionism as well. And so ideas of nationalism of other countries was seen as a dangerous thing, understandably. And so it was communism which ultimately did overthrow Russia in the end, when the Tsar was not reading the tea leaves correctly. So in and amongst this, this yeshiva, as the mother of all yeshivas, as the most famous place of the greatest Torah teachers throughout the Lithuanian world. We're not talking about the the Hasidic world, which did not have a centralized location. But this became a target for the Russian Empire. And so therefore, throughout the course of the Netziv's 40-year duration as a Rosh Hashiva, he was consistently leveraged by the Russian government to diminish Torah study and to incorporate secular studies in the yeshiva all the way through. And there's a great debate, which is worthwhile being aware of, which is by this book, which was actually banned by Lakewood. It's called My Uncle the Netziv. It's the translation of Rav Baruch Epstein, which is that's the nephew and ultimately brother-in-law of the Netziv, who wrote about his uncle. It was translated in the 80s into English. And actually, it was sent out as a gift. If you look on the back of it, it's published by Masora Art Scroll and the Cheder of Lakewood. It was sent out to donors. And then they realized that they didn't like some of the things that were said. And so they sent a retraction and they banned this particular book. A lot of the concerns were around, there's a lot of things. This is not your average Art Scroll biography. Maybe we'll spend some time with the Torah Tamima, Rav Baruch Epstein, next week to just spend a little time just to appreciate him. He's a very colorful individual, very, very fascinating Talmud Chacham. But so in his description of his uncle, it was complex. And he, one of the things that he's criticized for is describing how his uncle used to read the newspaper on Shabbos morning, the two Torah newspapers. And the contention on the other side is that's not true. He would never read the newspaper on Shabbos. So there's a lot of concerns about that. Another aspect of it was this particular issue: is did the Netziv concede to the Russian Empire to allow secular studies in the yeshiva? The Rav Baruch Epstein argues that yes, he allowed. They forced him to the point that he allowed minimal amount of secular studies, 2 hours of secular studies at some point in time in the curriculum. It was in 1892 when the Russian Empire demanded the following requirements, which was secular studies from 9 to 3 p.m., no Torah studies at night, all the staff had to hold a degree from a Russian institution of scholarship and teach in Russian, which basically means there's no yeshiva left. At such point, that's when the Netziv closed the doors of the yeshiva, because there was nothing left, right? They became the target of the Russian Empire to homogenize this yeshiva, which ultimately led to this. The debate that's had is what happened before. Was there concessions made beforehand? It seems that there were. If you want to read a very fascinating essay, Rabbi Jacob J. Schechter, or J.J. Schechter, has a long, long essay about this topic, about whose narrative is more correct, the Lakewood narrative of retracting this book or the Rav Epstein, his nephew's book. It's very, very fascinating, a really long and extensive essay on this particular topic. Lots to be talked about, because obviously this matters, because how did the Rosh Hashiva of the mother of yeshivas conduct himself, and how do we thread that needle about the concerns of secular culture outside of us and the Torah culture within? And you can see what the Netziv is saying over here when he says it himself, when he talks about the Migdal Bavel, is a country which will not let people think otherwise, right? A country which forces upon their culture upon pain of death. You can understand the cultural, we'll call it reflections in this as well. Here's another example of the Netziv, I would say, in a very liberal perspective of the way he looks at the Torah. The Torah tells us, Somtosim Alech HaMelech, when you ask for a king, you can make a king. And the question which is had is this a mitzvah? Is this a mitzvah kiyomis, a mitzvah chiyovis? Does the Torah expect us to establish a monarch? We talked about this a few weeks ago from the eyes of the Barbanel talking about the ills of monarchy. Listen to what the Netziv says, a remarkable statement, which I believe is the MS. I believe this is the closest to the truth of any interpretation of the Torah of this. And that's, you don't need my recommendation at all, but just understand what he's saying over here. He asks, why is it that it's dependent on your requesting a king? Meaning, if the Torah believes that monarchy is a mitzvah, then the Torah should say, you should establish a king. It shouldn't be, if you ask for a king, then you should establish a king. Why is it set up in such a way? And so the Netziv says the following. He says on the top of page 5, Venera, this is the old print, I apologize, I was taking from earlier, this is the old print of the Netziv. He says in the Rashi font, Venera, Dinishum da hanogas medina mishtaneh im misnaheg al pi das melucha or al pi das ha'am venivcharehem. Different nations have different systems of government. Some have monarchs, some have democracy, and people who are voted in. There are countries which simply cannot have a monarch. They cannot have some autocrat telling them what to do. And there are some places that just need a good dictator. Look at the Middle East for a large degree, right? You take away a monarch, everything falls apart, right? Terrorist groups. You know, you need some sort of strong, terrible person with a moustache, and everything, you know, everything seems to work out, right? They need some crazy person without elections. So Torah can't now walk in and lean in to a particular country and say, you must have a king. The way the system of government is going to affect many people's lives. Who's going to be killed for not being in compliance with the government? How's that people going to navigate? Is there going to be a police force? Which is therefore push aside a mitzvah saseh, the Torah telling us one way. Mishumachi therefore lo yafshal tzavos vehechleit lemanos melech. Kozman shaloi ola baskamas ha'am lispol ol melech. The Torah can't command us to have a king if the people won't accept a king. And so therefore the Torah tells us, if you ask for a king, use that form of government. You need to have a form of government. But figure out what the form of government. If you want monarchy, then you will have a monarch. But the point is that, and this is a realistic perspective of the complexity of an infinite document, the Torah telling us about how we're supposed to live throughout all the generations, when at that point in time there wasn't even the possibility of democracy. But it gives the space for democracy in the sense that it doesn't tell us there's only one way. That's the way the Netziv understands this. And think about that kind of thinking, living within a monarchy right now, and saying, being able to understand this. What a remarkable perspective. And what he's saying is so true. It's so true in terms of even today. You think in our enlightened world, everybody likes democracy. It doesn't work for a lot of countries, right? So you say, no, we should force it upon them. Well, look what happened in Iraq. You think that's working? They like democracy out there, right? So you have to figure out how this works. Now, I'd like to just charge into some of the most remarkable perspectives of the Netziv. Everything he says is golden. But let's take a few of them for an example. Let's go back for a moment to a very famous question which was asked by the Ramban already, where Yosef is sitting as the viceroy of Egypt, and in walk his brothers, and he recognizes them, they don't recognize him. And it says then that apostle, Yiskor Yosef is a chalamois, asher chalam lohem, v'yemalahem raglimatem. He remembers the dreams, and he accuses them of espionage. So why is it, what is the connection between those two statements? Why is it that he remembers the dreams, and then he accuses them of espionage? So Ramban says, quoting Rashi, because he remembers that now that the dreams have been fulfilled. He dreamed that they're going to bow down to him, and now they're bowing down to him, to them. So now he exacerbates the issue. Rashi doesn't explain why he makes the accusation of Miragli, but he remembers that the dreams have been fulfilled. Says the Ramban, the dreams haven't been fulfilled. How can you say that the dreams have been fulfilled? What's lacking? The dreams were, let's go through them quickly. There was the grain, right? There were the bales of hay. There were 11 bales of hay and him in the center, right? Well, how many bales of hay are there now? There's 10, right? Because Binyamin's missing, so it's not fulfilled. And then the next dream is about the Shemesh V'Yarech, mother and father as well, and they're not here. So says the Ramban, haha, now Yosef realizes he needs to orchestrate the fulfillment of the dreams because they're not fulfilled. We're close. We're not there yet. That's why now he gets to the next stage. That's a terrifying idea. Look, then Netziv adopts this idea. Take a look with me on the top of page 7. He says, Esa chalamois, shnei chalamois, the two dreams. Voidia akosuv, this is on top of page 7, it's source 9. Voidia akosuv, sheloi machmas nekima chasu sholem, misalech imam beakshus kazeh. Not because of revenge did he go through this ploy. Elamishum shenizkar achalamois shoya ke'ein nevua. He believes that they are not just a omniscience about the future. It is actually a responsibility. It's a prophecy. He said, I need to make sure that I'm going to facilitate the dreams in such a way. And that's why it has to be that he needs the brothers to come down before his father comes down, right? Because remember, the first dream is the brothers, the second dream is the father. So he needs to orchestrate brothers all being there first, and then father being brought down. It says the Netziv, you want to go further than this? Shocking. What happens in Parshas Vayigash? What happens is that finally Yaakov Avinu is coming down. It's now been over 2 decades of pain and difficulty. His father comes down. He sees Yosef, and it describes how he cries upon his on his shoulders. Look at this. The passage that describes in source 4. Oh, sorry, that's the wrong one. Source 6. Vayesor Yosef Merkavto Vayali Kras Yisrael Aviv Goishna Vayirah Lava Yipol Atzavarav Vayevkal Atzavarav Oid. So he comes and he falls upon his shoulder and he cries on his shoulders. Move, Vayomer Yisrael Yosef Amusa Apam Acharei Rosi Es Panecha Ki Odcha Chayam. I should die now that I see your face. The Netziv says, you notice an interesting thing is based on the Targum, you understand? is the following. Yosef actually dressed himself up in Pharaoh's garb. He dressed himself as the regent, as the power in Egypt. Why did he do this? He did this because he now realizes that the capstone moment is coming, which is when his father needs to bow to him, which is the second dream, right? So he knows, understand like the Netziv says, that a dream isn't simply a vision of the future, but it is a prophecy incumbent upon the person receiving it to fulfill. That being the case, he now needs to facilitate the orchestration of that dream being fulfilled. But what kind of business is that a father has to bow to a son? So says Yosef in his mind, what I'll do is I'll dress myself up as the Pharaoh, so that when my father sees me from a distance, after not having seen me from 2 decades, and sees the crown and sees the chariot, will prostrate himself thinking I'm the Pharaoh, thereby not allowing my father the disgrace of having to bow in front of his son, but thereby fulfilling the dreams in totality. His father does not recognize him. His father prostrates himself in front of Yosef, then realizes it's Yosef. And as he realizes, Yosef realizes why Yosef did this. At that time, Yaakov Yovin is in so much pain that his son needed to dupe him into bowing in front of him. That's when he needs to recess himself and say Shema Yisrael, which is why Chazal say Yaakov Yovin is doing, which is why he's not crying. Yaakov Yovin is so anguished because after all, V'aviv shamaras adavar, his father believed in the dreams. You can fool your brothers, but you don't need to fool me, says Yaakov Yovin. Why did you think you needed to play me? You could play them. You could have trusted me. And at that point in time, that's when he recesses into Shema Yisrael, and he cannot be in the same emotional space in the climax that Yosef is in. Again, this is a very unique perspective that the Netziv is sharing, but based on the complexities of the psychology and of the ideas of understanding a dream, which leads to the manipulation, which leads to this level of anguish. One has to be careful about trying to fulfill self-fulfilling prophecies, but perhaps that's the way it's understood. And this is what he says in Source 7 as well.
The Rochel was cast away, but he could never be 100% anyway.
That's true. It could have been the mother or the supplanted mother. We're not sure.
And he didn't orchestrate them coming to Egypt in the first place.
No, you're right, but that's the point. Is when he saw them arrive, then he said, now's the time the dream needs to be arrived. I need to get Binyamin down here somehow. How do I get Binyamin down before I get my father? I need to create this whole episode to pull him down. Once he's here, now I can bring my father down. I'll get my father to bow to me and thereby orchestrating the dreams. That's the way it's understood. And there's an element of cruelty in that, which is by necessity, at least the way he sees it, but the Netziv says he went too far. You can't play with people like that. It's too far. And that's when his father broke down. The Netziv has perspectives, again, which are very avant-garde as well in general, which are the nature of marriage. The Torah says to us that when Hashem created the human being, it says, Esela Ezer Kenegdai. And the every comments Chazal notice already that these are two opposite words. Ezer is a support, Kenegdai is against him. And so therefore the Chazal say, Zacha Ezer Lo Zacha Kenegdai. Meaning to say, if you're just a indifferent, callous spouse, then you're going to breed a relationship which is going to breed indifference and callousness. Yes, you choose the tone, right? That's what Chazal say. The Netziv says, and this is an idea which is so prevalent in our the way we converse, but it comes from him. Is he says the following in Source 10? He says, "Esolah ezek kenegdam mishum she'adam." Ain teva minoy ba'ofen echo. There's no character who's the same as anybody else. Kikol amidos the kol abruim kelulim boy. All the different temperaments are included in the human being. V'zeh adam tivoy noitel zeh ofen. V'zeh adam lehefech. People are different. Can you notice, by the way, he's transcribing what he said about nations to human beings now, which is very real, right? Meaning nations are different. They deserve different types of leadership. Human beings are different. We are. It's very hard to put people together. Al-Kain, yesh lasos ha-ezer, shia isha ru'uya la-kol ofen shia ba-ish, l'haynu kenegdoi. Eshu nitzrach la-ezer timidi lafi tichun asai. Meaning that it would not be a good idea. Like, you can imagine the following situation. You know, the guy is the Mr. Laidback, you know, and he like, you know, everything's all right. And he gets married to Mrs. Laidback. And the two of them both get up at 10:30 every morning, you know, and nothing happens and the bills aren't paid on time. And everything's all right until it isn't all right. And then you can imagine Mr. Anxious. Mr. Anxious has to worry about everything all the time because he always studies seven weeks in advance for every single exam. And he's always 10 minutes early to everything. And he's quite a highly strung kind of guy. And he marries Mrs. Anxious. And the two of them is like fuel and rock, fuel in the fire. And they can't do anything. Says the Netziv, you need to have a little bit of balance. Mr. Anxious and Mrs. Laid Back, or Mr. Laid Back and Mrs. Anxious need to work together, because together somehow they will figure things out. You can't have too much similarity. It's not going to breed a good relationship. You need to have a little bit of polar opposites to bring out the success in the relationship. That is Azer, Shehi Kenegdo. That's what the Nitziv is saying. Exactly. The opposite is the support, because we only become the better people that we become because somebody cares enough to pull us in the opposite direction. Otherwise, we'd just be the same curmudgeon that we were born as. Right? So we have to somehow be pulled out of that space. That's what the Nitziv says. It's worthwhile noting that the Nitziv himself was married to two wonderful women, and the first was the daughter of Yitzhak of Volozhin, Rav Malka Reina, Reina Batya, who was the daughter of Itzla. They were married for 40 years at a wonderful marriage, and she happened to be very academic, as the Rav Baruch Epstein describes. He describes her practices. It was her habit to sit by the oven in the kitchen, even in the summertime, next to a table piled high with svarim. These include Tanakh, Ein Yaakov, various Midrashim, and Naras Ma'or, Kava Yashar, Tzemach David, Shevet Yehuda, and many other books of this nature. She was very much an intellectual. After 40 years of marriage, she passes away. She predeceases the Nitziv. And his nephew, because remember, this just understand how the family works. So her brother-in-law is Rav Yechiel Michel Epstein. Rav Yechiel Michel Epstein is the author of the Aruch HaShulchan. Right? It's the Aruch HaShulchan, the preeminent set of halacha. Certainly before the Mishnah Berurah even was thought of at this point in time. So his son is Rav Baruch Epstein. This is the author of this book. And his daughter is ultimately going to be the second wife of the Nitziv. She's much younger, almost three decades younger than Nitziv when they married, but she got married to him at the age of 28. He must have been in his 50s, and they had children in the second marriage, including a person by the name of Rav Meir Berlin. You should know his name because he changed his name when he made Aliyah to Rav Meir Bar Ilan. Right, so the Bar Ilan University was founded by Rav Meir Bar Ilan, who's the son of the Nitziv, right? Who's the Bar Ilan? All the research which comes into the is as a function of that second, we're called that second marriage. And Rav Baruch Epstein actually was one of the people who suggested the shidduch for his uncle to his sister, which made them brother-in-laws. Very complicated family dynamic. Really, really, just fascinating. You should read. And all of these people are not. None of them are quiet people. All of them have a lot to say. So his children write. All his children write about him and about their relationships. It's a very, very fascinating. His older children, Rav Rafael, Rav Chaim, were tremendous Talmidei Chachamim who learned in the Volozhin Yeshiva as well, and ultimately wanted his son to be the Rosh Yeshiva. And there was a lot of contention within the Yeshiva. We'll deal with that perhaps in a moment. But just to understand this perspective he has over here, he has a lot of perspectives into psychology. So, for instance, when it describes how Pinchas, upon killing Zimri, was blessed with Bris Shalom, the covenant of peace, the Nitziv says the Bris of Shalom was peace with himself. Peace, knowing that he did the right thing, even though it took a lot of difficulty. That's something which is worthwhile thinking about, is how many times in life do we have to do something really difficult, that we don't sleep at night because we did the right thing, but it was very difficult. And peace is knowing that I did the right thing and being able to sleep with oneself as well. Just a very fascinating perspective that he says there. But I think the next point is something which really speaks to who the Nitziv is, a really beautiful perspective. The Nitziv has an introduction to many things. The Nitziv is very much into writing introductions and explaining what he's trying to do. So in his introduction to each of the Svarim of the Torah, one of the unique things that he does is he explains the nature of the name of each of those Svarim. And he uses a different name than we use. So for instance, we call them Bereishis Shmos Vayikra Bamidbar Devarim, but there are other names which are given. So the Baal Halachas Gedolos has different names to them, as an example. There's different traditions to names. So Bereishis is called, there's different versions of it. This one's called Sefer Yetzirah, one is called Sefer Yashar, the book of the upright. The next one's called Sefer Hasheni. He has a commentary as why is the book of Shmos seen as part B of the first one. Bamidbar is called Chomesh HaPekudim. So he has different names for each of the books, and he spends the introduction trying to explain the why that it is called such. So in explaining why Bereishis is called Sefer Yashar, the book of the upright, here's his observation. It's such a profound observation. that really speaks who he is in Source 12 in his introduction to Bereshis. He says, "V'yesh la'avin ha'tam lama kara bilam es avoseinu v'shein yisharim b'yichud v'loy tzadikim v'loy chasidim v'kadomeh." Why is it that that Bilam, when looking at the nation of Israel, calls them yisharim? Yisharim means upright, straight people. Why was that the terminology? Why is this book, Bereshis, called the Book of the Upright? Bilam says, let me die like a yashar. Why is this such an important currency? That in Azinu we say that Hashem's ways are justice and he is tzadik v'yashar. Hashem is yashar. Hashem is straight and upright. The Shevach Yashar who Neemar Latzdik Dina Kadosh Baruch Hu B'churban Bayis Sheni Shayador Ikeshu P'taltal U'Pirashnu Shayu Tzadikim Chasidim Amnei Torah. He says this is a Tzidukah Din. It's ratifying the justice of Hakadosh Baruch Hu, destroying the generation of the second Beis Hamikdash. Why? Because they were a complicated generation, not because of lack of scholarship. They studied so much Torah. Ach Lo Yu Yisharim Ba'Alichos Olamam. They were not upright in their way they conducted themselves in the world. Al Kain. So therefore they labeled anybody who wasn't behaving exactly like them as a heretic, as an Epicurean. They could not live with each other. They killed each other. And therefore, that was why the Beis Midrash was destroyed. Not because of a lack of Torah scholarship, but because of a lack of that distilling into the way you conduct yourself in life. You didn't live a yashar life. Therefore, when they ratified the justice of HaKadosh Baruch, when the justice of HaKadosh Baruch was ratified in Bashar Azinu, Tzadik v'yasharu, HaKadosh Baruch was yashar for what he's going to do that Dori Keshu Psaltal, which is the second Beis Midrash. Hashem does not like tzaddikim like these. He does not like people who live crooked lives in the name of heaven. This destroys the land. That's why the avos are called yesharim, and he gives examples. They loved God in the most incredible and magnanimous way. They were also distilled into their lives to be upright people. They interacted with foreigners, heathens, people who are pagans even. They were with them in love. And they cared with them for their good, which is the way that the creation should exist. Look at Avraham Avinu. He's praying on these people who deserve destruction by God. Why should he do that? He tried to pray for them. What is Yesharim? Why is it called the Book of Yesharim? Because Yeshar is meant to be the outcome of living a Torah lifestyle. Is living an upright way in which you live with other people as well. This is a remarkable idea. This is not the cloistered academic. This is not the person who's saying it's all about how many Sforim you have written. Right? That's not. That happens to be, he does that too. But he lives a much more balanced perspective on this as well. And this is something which was very complex in his life as well. He lived a very, very complex time, even within the yeshiva. In the yeshiva, his skan, Rosh Yeshiva, was a person by the name of Rav Yosha Ber Soloveitchik. He was the grandfather of Rav Soloveitchik of Boston NYU, ultimately. And he was a brilliant, maverick, brilliant mind. And he became a Rosh Yeshiva, and the two were giving shirim. And what happened was not as a function of them, because they had the utmost respect for each other, but the Talmidim started fighting with each other within the yeshiva. Why? Because the Netziv was very organized in his thinking. The Netziv was very much the Mesudar. We learn the Gemara. We learn a lot of Gemara in Rashi Tosos. And then we start going a little further into the Rishonim, and then into the Halacha and Shulchan Aruch. It was very organized, orchestrated. It was trying to understand the material. Rav Soloveitchik was all over. It was people. It was ideas. It was brilliance, interaction with the students. People were blown away by the brilliance of his mind. But it was a completely different mahalach in learning. And the students would start to fight with each other as to who is correct in their approach in learning. And ultimately led to a point where external rabbonim had to come and to orchestrate how the yeshiva would operate so to lead to less acrimony in the yeshiva itself. in very, very complicated times. There were times when there were chaburas of religious Zionists within the yeshiva as well. So, as noted, the Mizrahi movement and the Chovei Tzion movement were instituted from students or graduates from the yeshiva. And within that, there was a lot of animosity backwards and forwards about around these issues. When the Netziv talks about this notion of Yashrus, he's talking to a generation where there's lots of ideologies and competing ideologies which are fighting with each other. Just understand this comment about Yashrus as being is being able to be very religious and being able to live and coexist with other Jews of different stripes is something which is very important to be understood. And that, I'd like to now address perhaps one of the most famous stories that's told about the Netziv. It's the story about the shoes. This is the famous story. And that is that when the Netziv published his first great work, which was his commentary on the Shi'iltos of Rav Chaigon, he held a party, and at that party, this is what is told. It is not in his introduction. I went through the introduction of the Kidma Sa'emek on his commentary to the Shi'iltos, and he doesn't mention it in writing, but this is what's told that the story goes about his publishing. And he says as follows. This is the story which is related, that when he was a young man, he describes that he was having difficulty with his studies, his learning. And as his nephew points out, he was of average intelligence. He wasn't this photographic memory person who knew everything and could dissect anything just offhand. He worked really hard, but in his early years, what happened was he was up one night and he overheard his mother and his father talking about him as a student. And they were crying and they were saying, what's going to be with little Naftali? He's not shaping up to be, the scion of greatness that we expected of him. And at that point in time, he was actually thinking of leaving this whole business. It wasn't for him. It wasn't for him. He was going to go and become a shoemaker. He was going to get a trade, as people would do. They didn't know high school in those days. You went and apprenticed and you got a trade and you managed to help support the family. And because he overheard this conversation by his parents, who said, we'll give him one last chance at night, that was when he decided he was going to exert himself and really, really work hard. And he did. The stories I tell about the Netziv is that when he was falling asleep during his studies, he would put his feet in a bucket of cold water to wake himself up so he could continue studying. I mean, he really pushed himself to the excellence of what he produced. But the story famously goes that in the end of the day, he says, imagine if I'd missed that conversation. And I went and became a shoemaker. And then, at the end of the day, I would get up to Shemaim and I would say, where's the Pirush and the Shi'iltos? Where's the Velozhin Yeshiva? Where's the thousands of graduates? Where's the Ha'emek Davar? And he says, and I would say, what are you talking about? I made great shoes, right? And he says, and thank God I was able to overhear those conversations. It's a very complicated story. The story, you can understand how the story is used. There's a famous retort to the story that I don't remember who it was who heard the story, who said that sometimes they come to a person and they say to them, well, the person gets to Shair Shemaim and they say, well, where are the shoes? Right? It works both ways, right? You have to know where you're designated from. You have to be very careful with this. But I'd like to make an observation that's that's actually related to this week in Parshas Vayechi, which is such a profound observation about the Netziv's insight into this business. He makes the famous question describes the blessing of Yaakov Avinu to his grandchildren. It says that Yosef places his two children in front of him. Remember who's older? Menashe. Ephraim is second. So he places the two of them in front of them, and the pasuk describes very clearly in Source 17, Vayikach Yosef es shneim es Ephraim b'minoi mismol Yisrael ves Menashe mismoloi b'minyan Yisrael vayigash elav. So he places Menashe on Yaakov, his father's right, which is his left. Okay? And he takes his hands and he switches his hands. Why, says the Pasuk? Ki Sikeles Yadav, he switches his hands. Ki Menashe Abachor, because Menashe is the eldest. That doesn't make sense. That's the wrong reason, right? It says, Ki Ephraim is wonderful, he's got more skills, he's more adept, he's going to be the future. Give me another reason, but don't say he switches hands because Menashe is the Bechor, right? Right? That's not the right reason. So the Mepharshim say, no, Ki in this case means even though, right? Which is funny, because you have to, like, let me say that there's times in the Torah where the word Ki, which usually means because, means despite the fact, which is like the opposite, right? That's a strange way to read it. Says the Netziv, no. You have to understand what's going on over here. You see, There's another time that Ephraim and Manasseh are switched. Of course, you should all know this because we read the Torah. Naturally, everybody's in shul and they're always listening very pertinently to the Torah reading. So where's the other time in the Torah that they're switched? I can't, by the way, I can't take it when people are in shul and they're talking through the Torah reading. You know what the Chofetz Chaim says about talking through the Torah reading? God forbid. Forget the fact, do you really know it so well? You think you know it so well you can talk through the Torah reading? You have all the insights? It's like, it always shocks me. So you read through Parshas Bamidbar and Parshas Pinchas. And Parshas Bamidbar and Parshas Pinchas do what's called Chomesh HaPikudim. They count the nation of Israel at the beginning and the end of the desert time. 38, 39 years away from each other at the beginning and the end. And you'll notice something interesting is that in Parshas Bamidbar, it goes Ephraim first and then Menashe. And in Parshas Pinchas, it goes Menashe first and then Ephraim, which means Sikel es HaParshios. The Torah itself switches the parshas like Yaakovinu switches his hands. Isn't that remarkable? So what's going on? Says the Netziv, such an unbelievable insight. It's so obvious. Says the Netziv. He brings his two sons in front of him. If you wanted to switch who's getting the bracha first, what would you have done? What's the easiest way? Let's say you believe Menashe is not worthy and Ephraim is more worthy. What would you have done? You just turn them around. You'd like to say, no, Menashe, you go on this side, right? So that's not what he does. In other words, he keeps their feet in the same place, but he switches his hands. Do you notice that? Right, so they're standing in the same place. Menashe is still standing on his right, but Yaakov's right hand is on his head. His left hand is on his head, right? So what's happening over here? The Torah is explaining, why did he not switch where they were standing? Ki Menashe Bechor. Because Menashe is still the oldest. His feet are still on the right, but his hand is on the left. What does that mean? Why? He says, think about hands and legs for a moment. Think about what functions we use them. The legs are kind of at the bottom, right? They're habituated. In fact, the word regel is the source of the word hergel, which means habit. It's not, you're not thinking about it. You're just doing. You're just moving along, right? You don't think about most of the time you're walking. You're not doing anything creative with your legs, generally speaking, right? You could be a good sports person. That's great. But generally speaking, you're not doing so much with your legs. Think about your hands. Your hands come out between your brain and your heart, right there. This is where you write, you create, you fashion, you do, you orchestrate, you demonstrate. Everything comes from the hands, right? That's where the hands are. They are an expression of intellect. The legs are attached to what we'll call the lower regions of the body, the more complex material aspects of existence. So therefore, says in a tziv, Menashe was in fact his interpreter. Menashe was the person who was the agent who ran out to Binyamin. Menashe was the person who's going to live the life of politics. He's going to live the life of government service. That's really important, which is why his legs stayed on his right. Because it's all right to be a leader in this worldly matters. That's why he leaves Menashe there. But as a spiritual leader, that's Ephraim. That's when he's going to be Sikel Es Yadav. It's only his hands he switches because Ephraim is going to be the spiritual leader and Menashe is going to be the physical leader. It's all right. There's not one way or the highway. And the beauty of the bracha is being able to recognize both of them, one on the right by the feet and one on the right by the hands. That was what he was saying. Which is why when they go into the desert, which is the Dordea, where they don't need clothes and they don't need laundry and they don't need food and they don't need water and they don't need any of this, who's first? Ephraim. But when they go into the land of Israel, where they're not going to have clouds, and they're not going to have wells, and they're not going to have man, and they're going to have to plow the fields, guess who's first? Here's Menashe. Because that's the same sikel, that's the same switching that Yaakovina was doing. Again, that's like brilliant. Like so brilliant as well. That's why he says, Amalach Agola Simi Korai. He goes and explains why we say the bracha with Ephraim and Menashe, because understanding that children are different. Not every child is going to be the shoemaker, not every child is going to be the Rosh Hashiva. Understanding. Very good, exactly. And that, in fact, that were the bridge between the two sides of Israel, as it goes. And now I'll close with two last observations, and that is the following. This idea, people think, is a medrash. It's the Netziv. It's not a medrash. It is such a popular idea. Most people have no idea this is the Netziv. This is a very famous idea. The Torah tells us in Vayikra Perek Zayin Parshas Tzav that there's a korban called a korban toida, the Thanksgiving offering. The Thanksgiving offering comes with a bunch of bread. How much bread does it come with? 40 loaves of bread, four different types of 10 each, and you have a limited amount of time to be able to consume this. 2 days, I believe, 2 days and one night for the korban toida. So the Netziv says, how is that possible? Like, there's an issur of leaving over things that are going to become noisar, but you have to eat 40 loaves of bread. Have you ever tried eating 40 loaves of bread in that amount of time? There's only one way you can do that, and that is you invite everybody, friends, families, neighbors, all the people, you need to bring them in. He says, why? He says, because that's the point of the Korban Torah. The point of the Korban Torah is to publicize. Why are you bringing a Korban Torah? Because you escaped the desert, you escaped the sea, you escaped sickness, you escaped imprisonment. Something really crazy happened in your life, and you're now being liberated from it. You're not allowed to walk away. You're forced to talk about it. And everybody says, wow, that's amazing. You know, if it hadn't been for this, you'd wow. That's the point. You know, you're forced into the public eye to by the halachic ramifications of this korban. And then he says in the Harchev Davar, which again I've noticed many times, is the Harchev Davar in his footnotes is where he often comments on Tanakh, and he says this is a pasuk you'll never think the same about again in Tanakh because of this Netziv. The Netziv says we say in Halel all the time. So look at source 23. To you, I'm going to bring a thanksgiving sacrifice. And this is Ma'ashiv. He says, "V'shem Hashem Ekra, Nedarei LaHashem Hashalem Nedonan LaCholamoy." I'm going to pay my vows to Hashem. I will show it forth in front of all the nation. B'chatzos Beis Hashem Asochei Yerushalayim Yesh Lavin Ma'amar. He goes on to explain why is it necessary to be in Yerushalayim in front of everybody else? And he says because the Korban Torah needs publicity. I'm going to call on the name of God. I was saved at sea. I want to tell you about this. Everybody needs to know about that. That is why you were in that place, is to be able to publicize that. Phenomenal. That's his perspective. When people know this idea, most people have no idea this is the Netziv. They think it's a Medrash. That's how early this idea recalls as well. And finally, just a perspective of exile, we'll close with this as well, and that is that in Source 24, he describes how Yaakov Inu in Parshas Mikkei is very upset with his sons for telling the viceroy of Egypt that they have a brother, and he asks them why. Says the Netziv in Source 25, "Vayomi Yisrael, Ksiv Kan Shem Yisrael, Ki Boba Kana Lamdom Das Ladoros." It's not just Jacob, Yaakov Inu, who's asking this. It's Yisrael as so to speak, the precursor to the nation. A lesson to the generations abayim, which come afterwards, Asheyu begalus, they will be in diaspora. Ve'yamdu liyos mishpat lifnei adonim, sheloy ledaber yoser mitashuvas ala sha'al. Don't offer more information to the governments that ask you. Don't offer too much information. They will use it against you. Understand the role of a Jew in exile. And ultimately, when he was forced to close the yeshiva, the authorities entered the yeshiva in February of 1892 and ordered all the students to leave because they refused to bring, say, the ridiculous curriculum, which would have essentially obliterated the yeshiva. At that point in time, he made his attempt to try to make his way to Israel. And he died on the way. He died, as unfortunately many of these people did, in debt. He died in debt to the yeshiva, and he died a broken man at the end of his life, trying to make his way to the land of Israel, which he dreamed of. He didn't just support Israel; he supported people in Israel. And to perhaps conclude, just with a translation of the writings of Rav Meir Bar Ilan, his son from a second marriage, who describes his father's perspectives on this, and he describes how his father was always so respectful of Israel and supported people going there. He describes there was whenever he would come back from Israel, he'd sit them down for hours and listen to them and ask them all just questions. There was once a mashulach who came from Israel, and in the middle of the conversation, he got up and shouted at him. He says, "Leave, you're a meragel." The man says, "No, but everything I told you is true." He says, "Yes, the meragelim are also talking about the truth, but you can't slander the land of Israel." And he goes on to describe on page 13, in the fourth paragraph, he says, "One of the most distinguished students at the Volozhin Yeshiva, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, was particularly beloved to my father. He was once asked, 'How do you feel in the Volozhin Yeshiva?' He answered, 'I feel as if I'm in Eretz Israel,' an answer that was very significant in my father's eyes. My father was not just a supporter of Eretz Israel in spirit, but he also acted practically to strengthen the Yeshuv. He was very involved in the Odessa Vad, to the extent that on Erev Yom Kippur during Mincha, when the yeshiva students put on various bowls for tzedakah, he ordered me to sit down next to the bowl of Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael, and he himself dropped money into the bowl several times. The students noticed this, and more than 9 rubles were collected in the bowl, a significant amount of money in those days." It should be noticed that one of the places that he supported ultimately was called Kibbutz Ein Hanetziv, which is found in the Jordan Valley. So if you go up route, or just off route 19, there's Kibbutz Ein HaNetziv over there, and there's a picture of it today. And that was named after him for his support and his involvement in the land of Israel. One of the most complex and fascinating individuals of the 19th century, somebody who managed to straddle internal and external strife at the same time plot the course for the complexity of the future. Thank you, everybody, for taking the time to come today.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi.